Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Rural sociologist John Allen says that community creates the success or failure of a civil society. He's helped several communities trying to resolve serious conflicts. We do have many conflicts often in communities. For example, conflicts over land use in many areas of the West. John Allen's list of key mindsets required to achieve a civil society includes meet the weirdos. That's anyone who may be different from you. Cultivate a civil tone and personalize or get to know those on the other side as fellow human beings. John Allen is Dean of the USU College of Humanities and Social Sciences and was selected by USU honor students to give the annual last lecture, which he delivered recently at Utah State University. In the second half, we'll revisit a conversation with Lee Woodruff, author of In an Instant, A Family's Journey of Love and Healing. In January of 2006, the Woodruffs seemed to have it all. Happy marriage, four beautiful children. Bob Woodruff had just been named co-anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. Then, as we all recall, when Bob was embedded with the military in Iraq, an improvised explosive device went off near the tank he was riding in. He and his cameraman were hit, and Bob suffered a traumatic brain injury that nearly killed him. Conversation with Lee Woodruff in the second half today. And coming up next, my conversation from yesterday with rural sociologist John Allen.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
On this part of Access Utah, we're pleased to be joined by John Allen, Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. Dean Allen gave the last lecture, which is an annual lecture at Utah State University recently. The lecturer is selected by USU honors students. Dean Allen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So this isn't the last lecture you'll ever give, hopefully. This is just the idea is if this were your last lecture, this is what you'd like to say to the students.
Yes. When the students first came to me and said, this is your last lecture, I said, I'm not that old yet, I hope.
Right.
I hope there's still a little bit of intellect available. But no, it was an opportunity for me to reflect on 30 years as a rural sociologist and as a faculty member and a teacher and say, what would I share with young people? So I was very humbled, and it was rather exciting as well.
Before we get into that, I'd like to paint for people a little bit of your background. I happen to know some of this. You have been in radio.
Yes, I have.
You were a news director and various other things in radio before.
I started out as a sports writer, went into radio in Eastern Oregon, was news director there. Then I went to work for the Associated Press, so I spent some time in journalism. And I've had a variety. I've been a farmer and a rancher, done marketing research, been a faculty member, and now I've gone to the dark side, and I'm in administration.
Yes. No return from the dark side there.
From what I've heard, that's the case.
So rural sociology, what was the attraction for you there?
Okay, I grew up on a ranch in Eastern Oregon, and there were four generations on that ranch. And what I noticed was their personal experiences ranged everything from horse and buggies to rockets going to the moon. And yet somehow they crossed those divisions and were able to manage a 7,000-acre ranch. And at the same time, I had a feeling that as the world became more cosmopolitan, that the rural voice was fading away. And I thought that maybe this would give me an opportunity to study and work with rural people to create a positive future, but also to provide the rest of the world with a voice from rural America. And so that's what took 30 years, actually.
Yeah. So this is, I guess, in part the reason is what you grew up with, so what you're interested in.
Exactly. Yeah. I've lived in small towns. I've worked the land. I've been on a village board on Beaver Crossing, Nebraska, so I've been in government of a town of 497 people. I've been able to travel the world and see rural people in different contexts. So that's really what my interest was, and that led into policy, working both at the federal and state levels of primarily saying, don't forget that there is a rural context. It's not bad, it's just different. And that when you make policy and make decisions, please don't forget those individuals and those places.
Is there more work being done overall in urban sociology?
I would say yes. Mm-hmm. Part of it's where the money goes, is where the people are and where the votes are.
Yeah.
And so for those of us that took on the issue of rural sociology, we were looking at the social issues associated with rural people and places. And since about the 1950s, there's been a question of, should we even study rural in a cosmopolitan world? Mm. If everybody has satellite and cell phones, then everybody's the same. And it was interesting. I was at Portland State University studying urban areas. I would go back to Eastern Oregon, and in Portland, they kept telling me everybody's the same. And I would go back to Eastern Oregon and said, no, they're not. They look at the world differently. Their everyday circumstances are different. And so that kept me engaged.
So there is an essential difference in the worldview.
Yes. Yeah. Part of it's cultural. Part of it's tied to the type of everyday activity, the employment that people do. Oftentimes, it's more individualistic. With farmers and ranchers, oftentimes they're alone, where in urban areas, it's a much more social and collective type activity. There's also a myth associated with it that when we're rural, we're independent. We don't believe in supporting other people through government, and that makes me smile, because some of the largest federally funded programs go to those independent farmers and ranchers around the country. In fact, I've argued in some of my work that rural people are actually more dependent on one another than urbanites are. There's not as many services available. Mm-hmm.
And so even though you're more spread out, you're more dependent on your,
exactly,
on your neighbor. Yeah. So I'm reading an article on what you told the students in your last lecture. It has to do with community, right? And resolving conflicts.
Right.
Tell me your essential message there.
The message derived from 30 years of working in small towns, where there's often conflict between newcomers and old timers, between Native Americans and Anglos, between who controls the schools, all of those issues that I've dealt with. And then at the same time, I'm watching our contemporary society, where the world's black and white. The world is now, you're either for the snowmobilers or the cross-country skiers, you're for the Tea Party, or you're for somebody else. I'm seeing this fragmentation of values, but also of our ability to have conversation with one another and be part of a whole. So as I reflected on what would I tell young people, it was about the role of community in facilitating a civil society. And it moves beyond civility. Civility is so that you and I can have a nice conversation.
Right.
I smile, I listen to you. Civil society, what I've tried to share, really is about the ability of restructuring our relationships so that people you don't agree with, you're still embedded in that social network with. And what I found in my life when I'm mediating conflicts is that's the only way to come to some type of consensus that says, we don't agree on everything, but we do agree on some things.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be the glue that keeps us together.
And this, I'm sure you would say, is essential if we're going to go forward as a community.
It is. We have a perception in this society that everything's individualistic. You pull yourself up by the bootstraps. That everything you as an individual does, it's about your own self-interest. And if everybody does that, the system works. I come at it with a different philosophy that says collectively, we can raise everybody. And one of the ways that we have to do that is to make sure that we can listen to diverse opinions about how the world should work and where it might go.
So this is not to say that individualism is bad.
No, not at all. It's been very good for me.
Yeah.
But I do think that sometimes we put so much weight on it, we forget that the community, those people that live around us, that share our environment, our government, our services, that they're also part of our world. And that there are times I have to moderate my self-interest so that your needs get met as well. Mm-hmm. And so self-interest is important. It allows us to express ourselves and reach levels that we probably couldn't reach otherwise. But I still would argue that we're only as strong as our weakest link, and that we have a collective responsibility to other individuals that are part of our community.
If you just joined us on this part of the program, we're talking with John Allen, Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. He was recently selected to give the annual last lecture by the USU Honors students. And based on his research in rural sociology, he gave a lecture on community. And community creates success or failure in civil society. You have several bullet points. I'd like to go over those as well. But Dean Allen, our guest for this part of the program, as I was reading this report on your talk and your last lecture, my mind immediately went to land use issues. That seems to be the ongoing conflict, not only in Utah, but many Western states, and many of your bullet points fit that specifically. But you have some examples that were cited in this, one in Maine, that you have another example from Native American areas. What do you tell us?
Yes, I started with the Sagebrush Rebellion in the 1970s when I was in radio. And I was out. There were the Posse Comitatus in their white cowboy hats and their badges and their 45 pistols standing on one side of the gate, and the wind's blowing in the wheat fields. And then the government's on the other side. And I was out there running up and down the line thinking, this is going to get me on national coverage. I'm going to be on the AP. This is so exciting. And we're standing there, and a young man who happened to be at a federal agency in a rural community walked up to the fence. And one of the ranchers looked at him and said, "Don't I know you?" And the young man said, "Yes, you do. I took your daughter to the prom." And all of a sudden, that individual who thought he was fighting the federal government realized that what he was fighting was the young man that took his daughter to the prom. Mm-hmm. And they actually stood around for a few minutes and left. Mm-hmm. And it dissipated. And I reflected a little bit on that. I then ended up in Maine, which is clear across the country. For a ranch kid, that was quite an interesting process. But we had wealthy individuals coming from Boston and New York buying some fancy homes on the coast. Unemployment rates 40%. Poverty rates running 25 to 35 consistently. And the locals felt that all of a sudden their world was being turned upside down. And so after some fires, some arson fires, some attempts to kill a doctor, we actually decided to bring the individuals, put them on an asphalt-paved parking lot with granite hills, the Atlantic Ocean on one side, federal marshals up at the top, and I asked everyone to bring pictures of their family. And they all lined up, the outsiders and the insiders. And I would, by hand, take them to the other people and say, "This is my daughter. This is my wife." It didn't solve everything, but what it did was all of a sudden, because you were the enemy and I didn't personalize you, I now knew that you had a daughter just like my daughter, and you had a family. So instead of being this alien individual that I hated because you were changing my life, all of a sudden I personalized you. We were able to reduce that conflict considerably.
Hmm. Hey, you have another example. This is a tense coexistence, I guess, at that point between Native Americans and... And another community?
Yes. We had a civil rights case that had been filed nationally, and I was asked to come in by the Native Americans to facilitate a discussion. It stemmed from 100 years of tension. They had been relocated to a reservation, and the government accidentally gave land right in the middle of it to some Dutch settlers. So 100 years go by, and lands move back and forth. The Dutch settlers become farmers, conventional farmers. They make good livings. The Native American population continues in poverty. The school board members were all Anglo. The elected officials were all Anglo. So the Native Americans decided they didn't like that. We spent 6 months, 4 to 6 hours, 3 or 4 nights a week, having a conversation. And the first was just venting. The frustration and anger by the Anglos, the frustration and anger by the Native Americans. And after 6 months, we redistricted some and so that we could make sure that Native Americans be elected to boards. And I left and thought it was a failure. And I happened to be at a meeting at a courthouse in rural Nebraska, and a school bus pulls up. And these young Native Americans kids come out of it, and they made me dream weavers, or dream catchers, excuse me, with their pictures on them. And I was frustrated. I mean, I didn't expect this. And I asked the teacher, what's going on? You know, that was a failure. I didn't work. And she says, you have too short of perspective on time. Hmm. It did make a difference. Mm-hmm. We talked to one another.
Right. So the venting was a start.
It was important for everyone to understand the pain that everybody else felt. Pain is human. And it reaches across social classes, ethnic, gender. And once individuals saw that, the other people cried as well. I mean, this is emotional. It's a pretty high level conflict. And when they saw that you also had fear and anger and pain, that leveled it. And so part of it was just to let the others know, I hurt, I feel really bad, I feel degraded. And the Dutch were saying, I feel isolated in my own community. I've been here 100 years. My kids went to the school. We go to the same churches. Mm-hmm. So yes, the venting is important. And then from that point on, you work to find those things that you can agree on, not the things that you disagree on, because those are usually at the margin. And so when you talk about public lands, we deal with the margins, the black and white world. What pain and the humanity aspect of this does is it levels it and says the world's not black and white. You have some value the way you look at the world. I may not agree with it, but I can look at you and see that it's real.
And I think I have been seeing, I don't know if you see as well, more groups, more people trying to use some of these principles, specifically on the land use issue. I see more people kind of trying to come in from the extremes and work out some agreements.
I'm seeing examples of it. If I look nationally, I don't see it. I see the red states, blue states. I see the black and white world. That's why I think community is so important. I've actually come to the conclusion that you don't change the world at that macro level. You change it at the community level. And at the community level, you and I can sit down and you can bring your snowmobile and I can bring my cross-country skis and say, how do we both have a time to enjoy this land? Not destroy it, but to still be able to enjoy it in our way. That happens at local level. It's not going to happen at the macro level.
In fact, it seems to be going the opposite way if you take national politics. You know, parties purging their moderates, going to the extremes, yelling at each other. This is part of the frustration that a lot of people feel with Congress, with the system.
It's easier, and I think technology, as much as I've written on information age, I do think technology may feed this a bit. I can now spend my time just interacting with people who think exactly like I do, which solidifies my beliefs, and it actually reduces the amount of information I get from others. So pretty soon, I believe the world really is black and white, and not color. And so I think we need to begin having discussions about what's important to us at a very base level, where right now we're onto some ideological debates that are in a black and white world, that as I work with human beings, I find out that their world's not as black and white either. And those are the things that I would like to see us facilitate. It means working with beyond the group that you're comfortable with. I said, meet the weirdos, as one of the statements I told the students. And that's to engage individuals from different backgrounds who view the world differently. Your world will expand as you listen to how they view it. And so we've seen some of this in land use. We see some of this in urban areas around gang violence. But I think we've got a long ways to go. And I think our focus at always looking at the national as a way to fix this is probably not the way to do it.
To follow up on Meet the Weirdos, you've seen successful examples of how this works.
Exactly.
But there's a danger there, at least perceived by people of a group, that if you do meet the weirdos, you are then seen by your group, perhaps, as disloyal and and suspect.
Oh, yes. Yes, that makes me smile because I've seen it. I mean, when you saw the posse comitatus talking to this young IRS person across this fence with the wind blowing and the dust and the grain blowing in the background, you could see that there was tension on both sides about, is this person now no longer one of us? And part of that's our responsibility as a community to begin saying, we're going to expand our definition of who's us. And if we do that, we'll come up with innovative ideas on how to solve solutions. But you're exactly right. I see that. We see that. Facebook allows that. All of a sudden, you can get thousands of messages out there in the world saying this person's a bad person, and here's a photo of them doing or talking to someone else. I'll be honest. When I started 30 years ago in policy and federal government, we would go and have dinner, and there would be Republicans and Democrats and independents. We'd all eat together and talk about things such as how is it to have a house here and one back home? How is it to get your clothes clean? All of those really basic things. Go to Washington, D.C. today. They're not even in the same restaurants.
Yeah.
And it saddens me because I think it weakens us as a society, and it doesn't allow the innovation of new ideas to occur that will lead us to the future.
So you've said that your hope lies on the micro level, okay, not the macro. Do you see evidence that this is proceeding? Do you see hope out there on local issues? Of course, we've talked about how it's very depressing when you look at the national level, yeah, but are there hopeful signs on the state and local level?
I do see hope. Now, I have a little pink in my glasses, so that I'll share that with you before I explain this, but I do find hope out there. I saw when we were dealing with Logan Canyon, it was conversations from people who had quite diverse views about how that canyon should be used and who should control it. That was community. I was just down in the Blanding area and coming through Moab, and I'm thinking back 20 years when the mountain bikers and the uranium miners were still having tension. What's emerged from that is a very strong community. They also have strong economy. Their political structure is very diverse. I see the same thing in Price. So I'm seeing examples of people who say, okay, I have these values and I have these beliefs, but I'm going to set them aside and listen to you because you're part of my community. You're my neighbor. I see you at the grocery store. My kids go to school with your kids. We are entwined. And that may mean I have to step out of my ward. I have to step out of that ability to just connect with people who view the world as I do. I think we grow personally. I mean, what it's done for me in meeting weirdos was it, as I told the students, it changed my world from black and white. When I was a kid on the ranch, we hated government, we hated hippies, we hated urbanites. We had a long list of those people we didn't like. And then as my world grew, all of a sudden, I found value in all of those different pieces, as well as those that I'd valued as a youth. And so it adds. It adds color to our world. It makes decisions more difficult because now I have to take you into consideration where up to now I didn't have to. Mm-hmm. You either aligned with me and were my friend, or you were the enemy. And I'm not sure that's the way the world is.
Mm. We're talking with John Allen, Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences, on this part of Access Utah. He gave the last lecture. It's an annual lecture by a faculty member summing up the core message of his or her research for the students, selected by USU Honors students. This year it was Dean Allen, and he's talking about community. Community creates success or failure in civil society. And by the way, I've been quoting from an article, I give her credit, Allie Jepson, found in Hard News Cafe, which
is a
nice service. Just Google that, and journalism students write articles there. Allie Jepson's report on Dean Allen's talk. So I'd like to go over some of these bullet points. We've already covered some of these. Dean Allen says he's found success in various areas using some of these principles. Civil tone is important.
Yes. What I find is oftentimes when we move our statements public, we carve them in concrete. And that means I put a letter to the editor. It's now, I can't change it. One of the things that I found is that when we de-escalate our language, and I think of you as a civil individual as myself, I interact with you differently. So civil tone.
And de-escalate, you talked about,
exactly.
To take the stridents down. Personalize, we've talked about that, where you had the people on both sides in Maine take pictures of their family.
Anthropologists shared with me years ago that it's much more difficult to kill somebody after you've eaten with them. Mm-hmm. I think part of that's personalizing.
Meet the weirdos, we've talked about that, by which we mean meet somebody on the other side of the divide. Make connections.
Yes. My research has really dealt with social relationship structures, those social networks, that community. And I think it's all of our responsibilities. At the simplest level, it's the welcome wagon. who takes this individual and introduces them to this individual, and pretty soon you get a dense social network in the community. And that brings those diverse voices to the table. It also allows you to meet everybody, and your community becomes higher quality.
Another of your points, don't be so pragmatic. What do you mean by that?
What I've found is that oftentimes people come together with all the answers ahead of time. And so their goal is, how do I manipulate you to agree with me? And what I've found in successful communities, what they do is they go in and have discussions about what the future is, and new directions emerge. So those that come in and knowing the answers, my job is to manipulate you, is not the way to get to that positive future. It's to come in and say, I'll have a discourse. And out of that will come the positive future for our communities.
You mentioned the next point, don't have all the answers.
Right.
Take a piece of time. Look for new innovative answers.
Right. One of the things that surprises me is that because we're all socialized within our own groups, our view of the world is tied to that socialization process and who we align with, we don't find innovation. If you think about Europe and multifunctional land use, where farms actually farm, and then the urbanites go out and have wine and cheese under the tree, and that's part of the land as well. They maintain environmental quality. They get paid for that. That's rather creative. What we see is a farm is a farm, a park is a park, and they've combined those. And I'm not suggesting that we all move in that direction. I'm just saying that that's innovative, that moves us beyond the relationships that we always thought were real. And I just came from a meeting where a futurist was saying innovation comes from hooking two things together that literally didn't look like they would fit together. Hmm. And that's what I think we need to look for.
And your last point was enjoy it.
Yes. We're human beings. Even those of us that are introverts have to force ourselves sometimes to engage with the rest of the citizens. But almost always what I've found is when people put themselves in a situation where they're sharing information, learning about other people, that there's joy to that. And they go home, back to their world, feeling more comfortable, more confident, and a little bit more secure in the world they live in. So It should be enjoyable. It shouldn't always be this pragmatic, here's the goal, how do I get there, and we'll run it on Robert's Rules of Order.
Are there some communities, some conflicts, some problems that are just so intractable that these principles just wouldn't work?
Yes and no. I mean, I've had school consolidation conflicts that I've mediated that had every 30 years they went through a conflict. Every time the next generation got to the school, they had a conflict. But as newcomers came in and the population changed a little bit, the conversation at least helped mellow the conflict. It de-escalated. It added a human face to it. And that's painful. Because it's much harder for me, if I know who you are, to have this in the back of my mind that you're evil. And I've had people talk about, you know, they are the devil. They disagree with me. I know that they're the devil. Even those conflicts, we can help de-escalate. We can help personalize. We don't always find perfect solutions. And I would even suggest that in real life, there are no perfect solutions. We just work with what we have. We make it closer to community. And so we can move. I haven't found one that we couldn't make some progress in.
Mm-hmm. I could say some people who might respond to this saying that these are nice ideas, but it's a tad Pollyannish.
Okay.
Although we have talked about specific examples throughout, what would your response be to that?
Okay. For 30 years, I've had individuals say, you can't fix that. The old guard controls that community, or the Anglos control this community on the reservation, or in the Mainers, the wealthy were controlling it. And talking doesn't solve anything. Talking is the beginning. Having the discourse between human beings is the beginning. I think at times we have formalized our interaction to a level that we don't personalize it, and that allows us to live in that black and white world. So, yes, there's going to be some that say, one is it's unrealistic. The other is we don't have the time in this fast-paced world to engage in the type of dialogue. This is 1930s, 1940. I disagree. I think it's where we put our priorities. If we put our priorities that the collective is important, we all have a responsibility to connect the dots, to be engaged in the discourse, then I think the reality can be realized.
Finally, perhaps we've piqued some interest. A person has a conflict, school board or land use or whatever, and maybe wants to learn more, read more. Is there a place
where
they can go?
Yeah.
Contact you, I guess. Huh?
Oh, thanks. That's what I needed. As a dean, I even have a few conflicts in my life. There are conflict centers at Colorado, Washington State University. If they have an interest, contact me and I'll try to guide them towards those. So I'm not the only one who actually believes that we can have discourse and move to a positive future and reduce some of the pain associated with the divisions we see out there.
Well, we've been talking with John Allen, who is Dean of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University. He was selected by USU honor students to give the annual last lecture, and he talked about community and principles to resolve conflict. Dean Allen, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Coming up in the next half of the program, we'll revisit a conversation with Lee Woodruff, author of In an Instant, A Family's Journey of Love and Healing. You recall Bob Woodruff had just been named co-anchor of ABC's World News Tonight. Then in Iraq, he and his cameraman were hit by an improvised explosive device. Bob suffered a traumatic brain injury, nearly killed him. His wife, Lee Woodruff, has written a book about the family's journey of hope and love and healing. That is coming up following a break. I do want to remind you that we have three pairs of tickets to a belly dancing concert. That is tomorrow night in Logan. So if you're in the Logan area, or going to be in the Logan area, 7:30 tomorrow evening in the Taggart Student Center Auditorium. This is the Shimmering Sands Dance Company with special guest Thea, primarily modern Egyptian cabaret style of belly dance, but also a variety of Middle Eastern dancing styles. That's tomorrow night. All you have to do to get a pair of tickets is to call us at 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. Give us your name. You'll have to come by and pick those up because the concert is tomorrow night. Belly dancing concert. Tickets at 1-800-826-1495. Following a break, Ed Casilia commentary, and then Lee Woodruff.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Sam Winward, agent for New York Life Insurance Company, specialized in estate and retirement planning and insurance needs for businesses and individuals. Online at winwardfinancial.com.
The race is on. On a hilltop overlooking the city of San Jose del Cabo, work crews are hustling furiously to finish construction of a convention center where the world's top leaders will gather in mid-June for the G20 summit. They've already had one pre-meeting here. A couple of months ago, Hillary Clinton was in town to take part in some meetings and sign an oil deal with Mexico. The city was buttoned up pretty good, with local, state, and federal police all over the place, checking cars and keeping a lid on things at the airport. The federales even flew a plane in a couple of times a day. I'm not sure why, but we were at the beach one day and saw it come in and leave once in the morning, then do the same thing later in the afternoon. Landing the G20 was a pretty big deal for Los Cabos. There will be about 10,000 people from around the world who will come and go before the gavel falls on the final meetings. There's a lot on the table this year, too. There are the economic woes in Europe, the economic situation in the United States, presidential elections across the globe, trade and energy issues, and a host of other topics that surely will keep the world's top financial minds busy during all of the meetings here. What does that mean? Well, tourism officials will tell you it's positive image stuff for Los Cabos, which is true. But on a more important human impact level, what this means is jobs, jobs, and more jobs. They've got work crews going 24 hours a day to complete the convention center. There's also a lot of work going on around San Jose del Cabo. My wife and I escaped the condo the other day and ended up at Salsitas, one of our favorite gawking corners. Calle Obregón, the main drag for the art walk, was a buzz. You see, they're also working at a hectic pace to finish work on the old road there. They've widened the sidewalks, making them more pedestrian-friendly, and are redoing the streets with a very cool inlaid stone pattern. There were a couple hundred workers on the street, some mixing and pouring cement, others leveling the road, and still others doing the finish work. If you've traveled the highway, you've seen all the work they're doing there as well, from repaving the lanes to installing new curbs. I'd really like to be able to explain all that the G20 summit means, but quite honestly, it's pretty confusing to me. I mean, I don't understand how 20 guys from around the world can hang out a couple of days in a tropical paradise like this and fix the world's problems. All I know is that some pretty talented, hardworking people are pushing very hard right now to help Los Cabos put its best foot forward. This is Ed Casilia for Utah Public Radio. I got so many-
Coming up shortly, it's Lee Woodruff, author of In an Instant, A Family's Journey of Love and Healing. Just another announcement about the Shimmering Sands Dance Company. That's belly dancing. Special guest Thea is involved. That's tomorrow night, Friday night, at 7:30 p.m. in the Taggart Student Center Auditorium. And we have three pairs of tickets to that concert. If that's something you're interested in, all you have to do is call the program, 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. Tell our producer you'd like a pair of tickets. Give him your name, and you'll have to come and pick those up. 1-800-826-1495.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Bonnie Plants, plant grower since 1918, dedicated to sharing a love of gardening to help people become successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners. Information is at bonnieplants.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Lee Woodruff, author of a couple of books, also contributor to many magazines, a contributing editor to ABC's Good Morning America, co-founder of the Bob Woodruff Foundation. She's a co-author with her husband of best-selling In an Instant, chronicling the compelling story of her family's journey to recovery following her husband Bob Woodruff's recovery from a roadside bomb injury in Iraq. I think we all remember that. Bob Woodruff was named co-anchor of ABC's Nightly News, and then about a month later had that injury. Chronicles the recovery of Bob Woodward. Her second book is Perfectly Imperfect, A Life in Progress. And Lee Woodruff, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I guess perhaps that'd be a starting point, that accident. Maybe give us a picture of your family before then. This was a good time for the family. I imagine, at least for Bob, he'd reached the pinnacle of his profession there.
You know, he had it. So it's so interesting. I have said at certain points in time, just to illustrate that those moments, there were still, you know, cards and bottles of champagne and so forth and well-wishing notes from people sitting on the dining room table when all this happened. So it really went, you know, completely upside down. We had gone from feeling like the luckiest family in the world to all of a sudden, you know, wondering whether or not, you know, our dad and husband was going to survive. It was incredibly surreal.
And four children?
Four children, that's right.
And how old were the children at that point?
At the time, our oldest, my son, was 14. That's right, 14, and then my daughter was 12, and then we have twin girls who at the time were 5. They were in kindergarten.
Hmm. So how did you learn the news?
I actually got a phone call from my husband's boss. I was down in Disney World with the kids, if you can believe that. So it was a complete disconnect. I got a phone call that was coming in exactly at the time that I had set up my wake-up call for that day. And so I really honestly thought it was the wake-up call, and I had to sort of do one of those, you know, where the cartoon character's head spins around a little bit. Mm-hmm. when it was my husband's boss saying that Bob had been injured in Iraq, and they believed that he had taken shrapnel to the brain.
And so that's got to be hard to break that news to your children.
That was so hard. I slipped out of the hotel room because it was early, and I just began making phone calls to my family and just trying to collect myself and think about, you know, how I would describe this, because I knew the way that I would initially tell them the news would set the stage for how they would move forward from that point on.
And when you got to Germany, I'm reading an article here, the nurse advised you to look at Bob slowly, start at maybe his feet and look. So she was afraid you would faint.
She was. And I was the first one in the room with Bob's older brother, Dave, and she looked at both of us. I think she was trying to suss us out and see if we were the kind of people who would pass out. And I told her, no, I can handle this. And it was still really shocking when my eyes got up to his head and to the left side of his face.
This was a traumatic brain injury. Part of his skull was gone.
Right. They had his skull had been shattered in the blast with the force of the bomb, and so they had removed it. They did a phenomenal job. I can't say enough about military medicine and all of these docs and nurses and medics and people who rotate over there. Some of them are lifelong military personnel, but others are, you know, doctors and nurses from our own home states who give their time as reservists to work on our young men and women. And they had gotten Bob's skull sawn off 16 centimeters of his skull around the area of the injury within under an hour, which really is the first frontline reason, you know, why he's such an amazing miracle story today.
Otherwise, there would have been a lot more damage, I imagine.
Right, and before they kind of perfected this procedure, and unfortunately, they're doing it more because of these wars, than anybody should have to do them. But before that time, and what often happens in closed head injuries, if somebody doesn't get this surgery, is obviously when there's been an insult to the brain, even as simple as something like a sports concussion. I say simple because oftentimes they don't look like they're a big deal at the moment, but the brain begins to swell, and obviously when it bumps up against the bone of the skull and can go no further, that's when brain tissue dies and damage can occur.
And your husband, Bob Woodruff, spent quite a bit of time in a coma.
He was in a coma for 36 days. It was just, it's like a dream to me now. It doesn't seem possible that we all hung in there. I mean, people, as you know, you interview the gamut of everyone, I'm sure. People are capable of extraordinary things. And I think back now on how it was that our extended family and friends lived in sort of this world of hope for 5 solid weeks when it really wasn't looking good. And I marvel at that.
And you're having, I'm sure, report back to your children.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
I guess you just try to give them hope.
I did try to give them hope, and of course the conversations I had with the older two and the younger two were on 2 very different levels. But I found very simply that the kids didn't want, you know, any details. They weren't asking for details. They were just asking if I believed that it would, you know, go in the right direction. And I found in that juncture, I found faith to be a very big solace, because I could just sort of tell my kids, look, I believe that God is going to make your dad okay. And that was a place where I could put it, and I could put it for them. And that really was simple enough for them.
So that time when Bob was in a coma, I'm guessing that may have been the hardest time. You just don't know. You don't know.
Exactly. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Because what you're waiting to do is wait until that person wakes up so you can sort of see what they're left with, for lack of a better term. You know, will they remember me? Will they recognize us? Will they have words? Will they have physical movement? You know, how much cognition will be there? None of that is anything that any doctor can tell you.
And I'm reading this article. I imagine you had the full range of emotions, including anger at Bob.
You know, that came later, I think, when I just sort of thought, you know, what were you doing outside the tank? Well, I know what he was doing, and it was supposedly a safe area, and he was just outside the tank, you know, trying to film something and support the cameraman who was up there filming something. But you still think to yourself, you know, I want to just take it back. I want to rewind it and make it, you know, change it, make it happen. And I mean, like you said, there's such a gamut of emotions, but I think one of them was just sort of, I mean, the anger is kind of irrational because things happen. People are in situations. And of course, I knew that he was a journalist who believes that if our American troops are going to be on soil in a war, then somebody needs to be there telling that story. But I think it would be unusual not to feel that as one of the complicated range of emotions.
What was it like then when he came out of the coma?
That was just unbelievably joyous, and it was an incredible surprise because the night before that happened, I had literally been looking at acute nursing home facilities because he was really not doing well. He was not waking up. He was not following the commands, like, squeeze my hand, open your eyes. So they were really bracing me to tell me that this wasn't going in the right direction. And literally, I walked in his hospital room the next morning, and he was sitting up in bed. He'd been awake since about 3:30 in the morning, and he was wide-eyed, and he just looked at me and sort of said, you know, hey, where have you been? Like I had just stepped out, you know, down the hall for some coffee.
That'd be wonderful. Then I'm reading, and I know from reports that there was quite a long, slow recovery.
Yeah, recovering from a brain injury is not a quick heal. Our neurons in our brains are the slowest growing part of a healing process. They grow a millimeter a month. And so when those connections have been severed by a blast or a concussion or an impact, they need to grow back together, you know, to make those connections, to have the synapses fire again, to retrieve those words, to, you know, build up those memories. And it just takes a painfully long time and a lot of therapy and a lot of, going over things.
A part of it, language, right? Bob would forget words and...
Yes. Yep. And, you know, if you asked me what are his still residual issues, he would say, you know, he'll still stumble over words every now and then. And he's got such a great vocabulary, and he's got such great compensatory strategies that he can hide a lot of it. But, I can see, because I know him so well, I can see little deficits here and there where he's trying to retrieve words.
That's got to be especially hard for a journalist.
Yeah, I think it has been a very big adjustment for him. I think that he compensates for it well, and he does, still does a fair amount of live pieces, I have to say, but I think he, the taped pieces are probably where he feels most comfortable now, although I really shouldn't say that, because he finds himself in a lot of live situations, so that's probably not fair of me to say, but there's no question that, he has to think more before he's going to do something a little bit. But, you would sit and talk to him and you'd probably barely notice it. I'm talking about the things that a wife notices just because she knows her husband so well.
Yeah. I'm just curious, back parenthetically to when Bob was in a coma, what the doctors advised that you interact, for lack of a better word, hold his hand, talk to him. What do they advise?
Absolutely. They would continually say, he is in there. He's knitting this back together, and he's not ready to wake up. His brain is still, putting it together. So keep talking, keep, touching, keep playing music, keep doing all of the things that somewhere in there he's absolutely hearing, because that's helping to knit his brain back together.
How did the children react when they could see their father again? Some things obviously were different.
Yes. Well, when they first saw him, it was really upsetting, and it got to a point where, because he just wasn't waking up, and they really needed to see him just for reassurance. They needed to, understand that he wasn't dead. And that was hard, because nobody ever wants their kids to see their father in a coma. That was incredibly difficult. But when he was awake, I think they understood, and you could see, especially in the early days after the coma, you could literally watch his verbal and cognitive process double every day in the very early days. So I think, as disturbing as it probably was to see him, missing words or making up words in the early days, they were also watching the progress. And so that must have been very comforting on another level.
I imagine, I know that those who suffer traumatic brain injuries have a special place in your heart and in Bob's heart. In fact, you've started a foundation, right?
We have, the Bob Woodruff Foundation, and you can find more information online at remind.org, which is sort of our tagline, remind being a play on mind to the brain, and reminding people that there are those serving and those who have been injured. And we sort of act like a Robin Hood grantor, and in many ways, for lack of a better term, we take funds in, people donate to us, and then with our team of advisors from military and other walks of life, we take a look at the small grassroots organizations on the ground that are helping not only the veteran, but their family as well. And we make grants to these organizations where they might not otherwise get a nice infusion of cash to help in every area, from counseling and physical therapy to sometimes we'll pay an electric bill if a family's not making it. And just trying to get people back on their feet and back feeling like they can be employed and that they have dignity and everything else that goes along with that.
Well, this part of Access Utah, I'm talking with Lee Woodruff. She's author of several books, co-authored with her husband, Bob Woodruff, In an Instant, detailing their recovery from Bob's traumatic injury in Iraq. He was over there reporting on the war and the aftermath. It had just been named co-anchor of the signature news program on ABC, and about a month later was very seriously injured. Chronicles that recovery. We've been talking about that. And Lee Woodruff is author as well of a new book, Perfectly Imperfect, A Life in Progress. She also contributes to ABC's Good Morning America on the Board of Trustees of the Bob Woodruff Family Foundation, and is a successful author in her own right, having written for many magazines. I wanted to ask you about traumatic brain injuries. Of course, many reasons for the injuries, but this unfortunately has become sort of the signature injury of the wars. I think because of really good response and medical response, also the kinds of weapons being used in these kinds of wars. I saw an interview with you and your husband in USA Today talking about advice to those whose loved one has suffered a traumatic brain injury. I wonder, what would you advise people?
Well, I think take it slow. I think patience and taking a long view on this is in particular really important. And I also think that people are told still in the hospitals that after 2 years the healing is pretty much done. And they're revising that now and saying, you know, that's not true. The brain continues to heal. We're finding amazing things out about the human brain, and it continues to regenerate and heal itself years and years and years after an injury. And I think for those who are just learning that a loved one has been injured, I would say to them, it will never be as bad as it is early on. There's just so much that's unknowable. There's so much that's frightening. And it just seems a lot of times when I talk to people like they're just absolutely terrified, you know, as I was on so many levels. And like anything else in life, you move forward, you process it, you understand what it is you're dealing with, and you find ways to you know, go forward in your life. And there are so many amazing, the brain is capable of so many amazing regenerative things. I think there's a lot of hope.
And I imagine, well, and you say in this article, divorce rate is way above national average after traumatic brain injury. Some amazing stories of spouses who stick together, even though their spouse is not really the same person after, you know, especially severe injury.
Yes.
In some cases.
And, you know, I've walking in this world now in terms of having our foundation and meeting so many in the military and also in the civilian world, I do a fair amount of speaking as well to state brain injury associations and other groups. I've met so many couples, and I've seen the entire range of how this plays itself out. And many times it's not a happy ending, but those couples whom I've met who have stuck together through thick and thin really do inspire me, especially the military couples, some of whom also have so many physical injuries on top of the brain injury. And there are some incredible caregivers out there.
What advice would you give for families in the situation who have children? What advice with regard to the children?
One of the things I've found about kids is they're so amazingly resilient. You know, kids can process and absorb and kind of understand so much more than I think we sometimes give them credit for. And children are, they see things through their eyes, and sometimes it's really black and white. And so if daddy or mommy is just a little bit different, they will cope with that, I think, far better than we give them credit for.
What about caregivers? I'm sure you yourself, it had to be, on one level, exhausting.
It is exhausting. And the caregivers are people in this world, and they don't just have to, of course, be in the brain injury world. I'm watching my mother right now, and I write a little bit about this in the book Perfectly Imperfect. There's a chapter about my dad who has dementia. And I'm watching my mother, her exhaustion at, you know, having to get this man dressed, you know, who's like a toddler now and was her husband. And caregivers really are in a world that's isolated. They often feel exhausted, as you said, and underappreciated. And we need to focus more, I think, in this country on the roles that caregivers play, men and women, because they need a lot more support in many cases than they're getting.
I liked what you said in this USA Today article. You talked about sleep, you know, make sure you get enough sleep, try to get enough sleep, because you may get to a point where you just can't function.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of like having a newborn in a way.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I imagine it would be. What about, hopefully, the family, the caregiver has a network of people around them. What would your advice be to those people?
Support that person. Don't over-mother. Find out kind of what their needs are and just do them. You because after a while as a caregiver, you get tired, I think, of asking for help and of being that poor, pitiable person who always needs everybody to step in and help. And so as much as people can support with by just sort of silently, whether it's bringing a meal over or just going and walking the dog, I think when everybody asks all the time, it just makes you feel like that object of pity in the household.
Hmm. I want to move maybe to another couple of topics. Stood out to me, I went over to Huffington Post, saw some blogs. I think you write a regular blog?
You know, when I can, I pop in there and try to write something. I should be writing more than I am.
Yeah, at least lately it seems pretty regular.
I did a little college advice.
And this one I'm noticing now, it's from 2009, but it really hit me. It's about children with disabilities. You talk about walking down a road near your house. Saw a bright yellow children at play sign, and carefully written above those letters in deep black marker was the word autistic. And you talk about how far, hopefully, we've come as a society, but, you know, the things that parents of children with disabilities go through. You yourself have a child with a hearing disability, right?
I do, yeah, one of my twins. She wears hearing aids, and she's mainstream. She's doing incredibly well. But it makes you more sensitive, as the sign did, to all of the different nuances that go on with kids. And I don't think we were as tuned in. You know, I know we weren't as tuned into it 25, 30 years ago. And it's a good thing to see people, you know, asking for what they need, which is, you know, take care. This is my child. They just do things a little bit differently than your child, perhaps.
And you write at the end of this blog, you know, you had the urge to say, here's my child, or to explain what the sign said. Here's my child. This is what you need to know about him. Slow down, pay attention, and change your behavior. And you say there's a lesson in there for each of us.
Gosh, I haven't thought about that in so long. Thank you for reminding me of that one.
How's your daughter doing, by the way?
She's great. Mm-hmm. She's entering fifth grade, and she's got her hearing aids in, and she's doing wonderfully. She's had a lot of speech therapy and everything else, and you know, I've raised her to be her own person first, and that's just a part of who she is. Doesn't define her.
And you write that as you say, to embrace it. In fact, the hearing aids that she wore in bright colors. You know, here I am.
Yeah.
Maybe we talk a little bit about your latest blogs. You have. Fairly recently, sent your child off to college?
I sent one off last year, and then I have a daughter who will be a senior in college this year, so we'll be looking at colleges.
And you said you were, even though, you know, you and your son apparently didn't want to be on camera, he refused to, so you
no
did it from
interest.
The... From
absolutely no interest, yeah. He said, Mom, you have to do this whole piece. I did a story for Good Morning America last year, and he said, you have to do the whole thing. You can't put me anywhere in it under pain of death.
And I guess that's some boundaries kids of on-camera people have to set. But you say you're a bit surprised. You knew going in there were going to be some emotions, but you were a bit surprised by it.
I was, because I felt like his whole senior year had been a process of pulling away a little bit. He's a boy, henceforth. He's not a huge communicator. And it was just, you know, you get to the point in high school where you know their friends are the most important thing in their world, and you understand and accept that as a parent, because you know at some points the pendulum swings around, and you know they love you. But I really was blindsided with sort of the milestone of the whole thing, the enormity of the first child leaving the nest and how that felt, and I imagine it's going to feel just as important, you know, with a second child and a third child and a fourth child. But the first time anything happens, it you know, surprises you, I think, because you don't know. You know, I'll still cry when I drop my daughter off a year from now. I know I will, but I think I was just so blindsided because I thought I had it all together the first time.
Mm-hmm. Lee Woodruff is a co-author with her husband of the best-selling In an Instant, talking about recovery, the family's recovery, and Bob Woodruff's recovery from his traumatic injuries while reporting in Iraq. The second book is Perfectly Imperfect, A Life in Progress. You can also see Lee Woodruff as a life and family contributor for ABC's Good Morning America, and a few blogs on the Huffington Post, and also on the Board of Trustees for the Bob Woodruff Family Foundation. Lee Woodruff, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.